They used to tell me about the lands of the free, and I believed what they said. Just mention Roosevelt or Washington, Lincoln or Jefferson, and a tear would be shed. They used to tell me about the red, white, and blue, and I would fight any foe. So why am I just wasting away in Guantanamo? Once I made a phone call overseas, then they made it a crime. When I made a phone call, they spied on me. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I marched in protest, opposed to war, I sang and carried a sign. You can't march in protest anymore. Brother, can you spare a dime? When came my arrest? I was detained. There was no judge, no jury, no trial. Could not call a lawyer, so here I remained. Disappeared a long while. Oh, say when I was tortured. Yeah, I confessed, but I was out of my mind. They'd call Yankee Doodle a terrorist. Big brother, can you spare a dime?
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program starts out with an update on the impact of the BP oil spill. More than 1,000 scientists and government officials recently met in New Orleans to share the latest research on the effects of the 2010 BP oil spill on the Gulf of Mexico. And then after that, a new foreign policy. For more than a half century, the United States has been the world's biggest global straddling superpower, but now new questions are being raised about whether the U.S. can still afford that role. And then after that, the mysterious power of a hospital bill. Steve Brill went line by line through a handful of bills from hospitals around the country. He tells about the crazy thicket of high prices and hard to decipher codes that he discovered.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Steve Kerwood. Nearly 3 years after the BP Deepwater Horizon well gushed nearly 5 million barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico, there are still plenty of unanswered questions. And that is why more than 1,000 scientists and government officials recently gathered in New Orleans for progress reports on the extensive research that's being done on this largest oil spill in U.S. history. We called Mark Schlefstein, staff reporter for NOLA.com of the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, for an update. We started by asking what the research shows about the 2 million gallons of toxic chemical dispersants that were used to break up the oil spewing into the Gulf.
There's new research that does show that the combination of dispersant and oil is more toxic than either the dispersant or the oil on their own. Several of the papers did get into questions about both the efficacy of using that as a treatment method. There are real questions about whether or not that really was the reason the oil turned into tiny droplets. There's now research that says it might very well have just been the fact that the warm oil hit very cold water at large pressures from being a mile below the surface, and that caused it to turn into the tiny droplets even without the use of the dispersant. But what kinds of long-term effects, we're still waiting to see what happens with that.
Tell me about the seafood. Nearly 3 years after the spill, what's being found when it comes to the safety and palatability of Gulf seafood?
Well, that obviously is a key question that keeps popping up. There were a couple of people at a public hearing that was held as part of this that were saying, you know, we just don't trust the Food and Drug Administration. We know what shrimp do, and shrimp are moving through oily areas that still have oil, like in what's called Bay Jimmy. And those shrimp, you know, they don't just stop. They go out and somebody can catch them further out. But the Food and Drug Administration is sticking to its guns. An official at the conference made it clear that none of the samples that they have taken of seafood that is on its way to market has shown any problems.
Mark, tell me about the people who live in the Gulf. I know there's been a lot of research on the health of residents and folks who were involved in the cleanup. Generally, what have the findings been so far?
Well, even 2 years after the spill, people are still dealing with a variety of mental health issues, and that seems to be the most significant problem that's been discussed here. There also are reports of skin problems, people still having problems with breathing issues, coughing, those kinds of things, and headaches. A much larger study of people who worked in cleaning up the spill, which the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health has started, they have found biomarkers 2 years after the spill that are matching the oil from the BP well, still in the bodies of people who worked cleaning up the spill.
What are the socioeconomic effects of this spill on the Gulf region as a whole, do you think?
It really is a range of things. When you look at Alabama and Florida especially, it really destroyed their tourism business with the beaches. They're coming back now. There was a significant effort by BP to clean those beaches. Basically, they washed the sand or sifted it to get out all of the particles. When you get into the Mississippi Gulf Coast and Louisiana especially, you end up with more oil in wetland areas. There's quite a few individual locations having problems getting rid of the remaining oil. Whenever there's a storm, you end up getting new pieces of hardened oil coming to the surface or washing around. You can dig down a foot and you end up with a liquid material that is weathered oil, but it's still oil.
Now, what are the research needs to be done here? What are we missing from the body of knowledge about this horrific oil spill?
There are real concerns about things like porpoises, where there were many deaths over the last couple of years. There are concerns about sperm whales, which actually tend to feed about 20 miles away from the oil spill site. The other things that people are looking for are answers about birds, especially shorebirds and birds that fly over the Gulf, and what long-term effects there may be for them.
Mark, tell me, what's the latest with the legal settlements from BP and Transocean?
So far, we've got two plea agreements, one from BP and one from Transocean for criminal charges. BP has agreed to pay $4.5 billion to deal with both Clean Water Act criminal issues and Securities and Exchange Commission issues. Transocean has agreed to about $1.4 billion. So that part's done. BP has entered into a settlement agreement with private claimants. And that settlement agreement basically is expected to result in a minimum payment of $8.7 billion that would pay for medical, economic, and fishing claims. And then you've got the natural resource damage assessment process, and the estimates of that are as much as another $20 billion. There's a lot of speculation that there will be a settlement before the first part of this legal process goes to trial, which is supposed to be on February 25th. But at the moment, the negotiations over that potential settlement seem to be at a standstill.
Mark Schlefstein is a reporter for NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Picking up momentum. television tells you what to say. Never see it coming on. It's never news when you're in a police station. Back away, head for the main.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. My guest today says it's the whole American foreign policy grand strategy that needs to be questioned, the large and in charge global titan posture we've had for half a century. This hour, On Point, the case for and against pullback and a grand new global strategy for America. You can join the conversation. Is it time to step back, come home, time to drop the global cop routine and work on our own problems here, time to go light abroad and let the world sort itself out, or is that too dangerous? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton talking Benghazi this morning before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. In her opening statement, she talked about why the U.S. must stay engaged in the world's hotspots and pretty much everywhere else.
Let me underscore the importance of the United States continuing to lead in the Middle East, in North Africa, and around the world. We've come a long way in the past 4 years, and we cannot afford to retreat now. When America is absent, especially from unstable environments, there are consequences. Extremism takes root, our interests suffer, our security at home is threatened.
There's the diplomatic version. Here's the military version. If you were watching the NFL playoff games last weekend, you may have seen this ad for the U.S. Navy. It's a recruiting campaign. It's called a global force for good. It's been around for a year or so. They ran an ad there. Here's another one that was on the Navy's website. It's recruiting website.
The call to serve has no weight, yet I have held it in my hands. I will commit to carry it close to my heart until my country is safe and the anguish of those less fortunate has been soothed. And for those who choose to answer the call, for their country, for their fellow man, for themselves, it is the most powerful force on earth. America's Navy, a global force for good.
a global force for good. And if you saw the ad during the NFL game, there's a gigantic aircraft carrier, the deck sweeping beneath the camera, chock-a-block full of high-tech military aircraft. There's the global face of the United States on the military side. There's a call for pullback. Joining me now in the studio is Barry Posen, director of the Security Studies Program at MIT. His essay, Pullback, The Case for a Less Activist Foreign Policy, is in the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine and creating a lot of buzz in foreign policy circles. You can find a link to the essay at our website, onpointradio.org. Barry Posen, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
What's the case you're making?
Well, the United States has had a consensus strategy shared by Republicans and Democrats that centers on U.S. activism, U.S. presence around the world. The strategy made sense when the Soviet Union was a great geostrategic threat. It makes a lot less sense when the Soviet Union is not a big geostrategic threat. So the United States should review the strategy that it's pursued for the last 20 years and ask, really, how well is it doing? And if it's not doing well, why is it not doing well? And with what could we replace it?
As you describe this grand strategy that's been around for a long time now, since the final years of the Cold War and really earlier, it's more than activism and presence. I mean, as you say, the consensus that the United States should dominate the world militarily, economically, and politically. I mean, that's more than just a little activism. That is be the boss.
It is be the boss. We have lots of reasons or lots of explanations could be deduced for why the Americas behave this way. One is we do have a lot of power. When states have a lot of power, they tend to be seduced into using it. But second, the United States policy community entertains the idea that international politics can be transformed from a realist struggle for power and security into something else, that if America just presses hard enough, ultimately we'll solve all the world's security problems. We'll democratize, we'll marketize, we'll suppress military competition, and we're going to get to some nirvana-type state. And this is the promise, right? The global force for good. It means we're going to produce enough good at some point that everything's going to be fine. And these are fatuous ideas.
Well, look at that. What have the faces of this grand strategy been to people around the world? How's it been seen, experienced? How's it been projected?
Well, the Americans have their own view, which is we think of it as how, you know, our friends experience it, right? So the Europeans are completely happy with this strategy because it secures them at very low cost to them. We spend nearly 5% of GDP on defense, going down a bit. The Europeans spend perhaps 1.5%. So we're a great insurance policy for them. They love it. Mm-hmm. The Japanese spend 1% of GDP on defense. We're defending them. They love it. So we talk to those allies, they tell us how much they love it. But there are other parts of the world that people don't love it so much, especially the places where we've gone to visit with military power for the purpose of transforming societies. So we were not so popular in Iraq. There are different views about that, but somehow we had to spend as much money in Iraq to get a stalemate as we spent in Vietnam to get a stalemate. And the Iraqis didn't have the Soviets or the Chinese helping them, so the Iraqis really didn't like us very much. And I think we have to accept that the change that we wrought in Iraq was really not particularly great when all is said and done.
Not to mention Afghanistan, Libya, Somalia.
Well, it's a particular part of the world, but especially throughout the Arab world where, you know, we're not much loved, and the Americans engage in a kind of loss-chasing activity, which is we keep thinking there's some magical thing we're going to do that's going to make us loved in the Arab world. And it's probably not going to happen, right? We have a few interests in that part of the world. We should pursue them carefully and cautiously. But the idea that through the injection of a lot of American energy, we're going to make ourselves loved or that we're going to create stable democracy, I think we've tested this hypothesis. It hasn't worked very well.
But on the other hand, it's so deeply sort of ingrained, imbued in American sense of the world. When we see those ads at the NFL games, giant aircraft carriers, you know, all over the world projecting American power for good, it doesn't seem odd. It seems normal. It has been the norm. And plenty of people will say, look, we need that. You heard Hillary Clinton say, let me underscore the importance of the United States continuing to lead when America is absent. We just heard in that tape, Barry, especially from unstable environments, there are consequences.
And when America is present, there are consequences. The United States put its pool cue to the billiard balls of Libya, broke that collection of balls, and scattered weapons and terrorists all over that part of the world. When the United States decides to overthrow an autocratic government for the sake of spreading democracy, it should think a little bit about the consequences. I mean, these autocratic governments have often suppressed a lot of internal political competition. They've often amassed huge stocks of weapons. And when you knock over one of these governments, you're creating quite a lot of trouble for yourself.
The president said,
and if you go and try and manage the situation after you've knocked it over, I think we have evidence of how that goes in Iraq. I mean, first, you know, it's the old pottery barn rule that General Powell used to cite: if you break it, you own it. Well, we broke it. We owned it. We've spent billions of dollars and thousands of lives trying to glue it back together. The Iraqis themselves took the opportunity to have vicious civil war, which killed tens of thousands of Iraqis. So our presence was far from an unalloyed good. Sure, Saddam Hussein's an awful guy. I'm not sorry that he's gone, right? But this notion that there's a surefire solution that comes with American engagement is simply not supported by the evidence.
What have the costs been, monetary and otherwise, to this country of supporting this grand strategy of global dominance?
Well, there's a lot of different costs. First is just the cost of the wars. Something is happening in the world, and interestingly, it's a consequence of one of the good things that, say, the Hillary Clintons of the world might claim, which is we have a world of free trade and globalization and movement of information and all the rest, investment and expanding markets. But this means expanding skills, expanding capabilities, the diffusion of power, right? This is a fundamental question that needs to be answered. How did the United States spend, in real terms, as much money on the Iraqi insurgency as it spent on the Vietnam War? How did we achieve that? It happened for one reason, right? Which is the locals are simply much more capable than they once were.
Are you suggesting that by securing some kind of general Pax Americana, we've enabled a free flow of ideas that is redounded to our detriment?
I don't even think it's possible to talk about detriment. I think that we've helped create a change in the world over the last 50 years.
Isn't it the change you sought?
That change has been good for many people and produced many good things. But we also have to understand the other unintended consequences of those changes and adapt ourselves to those unintended consequences. And one of them is there's a lot more capability out there in the world.
What does that mean? Bring our money home and invest it in training here? Or you're up against tougher foes when you go there?
There's nothing you can do about that world you created other than try and take advantage of it. Trade, invest, do whatever you can. What I'm saying is you have to look at the military and security implications of it. And the military and security implications of it is that the United States is not the big dog it once was.
So you're saying we can't police it anymore? We shouldn't?
You can't police it the way you policed it before. You can't police it as much. You can't transform societies. There are things you should do. My strategy talks about U.S. basic national interests and what we need to do to pursue those basic national interests. My strategy talks about a much reduced U.S. military, but not a zero U.S. military.
We'll look at that strategy. Yeah, but maybe Americans want to police the world. George McGovern, this was decades ago. Now he said, come home, America. Zip for him. Almost nothing in the presidential election.
I think we need to understand that we have the same problem in our foreign policy as we have in our domestic policy, which Americans in principle want many things that they're not actually willing to pay for. Right? So we borrow for these wars. Right? We don't want to pay the high casualty of these wars, so we borrow more money to substitute capital for labor. We feel guilty about the soldiers we sent to these wars, so we borrow more money to provide additional pay and benefits for these soldiers. Right? So the notion that this is intensively supported by the American people, I think it's belied by the fact that the U.S. government never asked the American people to sacrifice for these goals.
Very pleasant to hold the thought right there. The big piece is Pullback, the case for a less activist foreign policy, a new grand strategy for America. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Saddam, what a bam bam, Bush and Saddam, Bush and Saddam, say Bush and Saddam, what a bam bam, Bush and Saddam. Still we don't want no war, only love and unity. That's what the people see. They don't want no war, no at all. Because if this war should start, this world would be apart. You wouldn't see no people. But less a shadow, there would be no more people at all. Yes, Bush and Saddam, we say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam with Bush and Saddam. Bush and Saddam, we say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam with Bush and Saddam. Mass destruction. We can't ruin Mama Nature's plan.
the earth is the Lord and the fullness thereof. Yes, them a perpetrate war. Yes, I and I need unity. Yes, them a perpetrate war. Yes, I say we need unity. Yes, Bush and Saddam, we say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam bit, Bush and Saddam. Bush and Saddam, we say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam bit, Bush and Saddam. I wonder if it's the oil, and the oil can't spoil. You rather taking people's life, fighting over the oil. Yes, to the world them won't put an end. They just say world without end. Right here now, my friend, you have big one from the drawing board again. Yes, you have the world in his hand. You can change your plan. Before one of your work pass away, heaven and earth bustle. Yes, peace and love we are the way. Peace and love we are the way. Peace and love what we want. Yes, in a Georgia side. Yes, Bush and Saddam, we say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam, Bush and Saddam. Bush and Saddam, we say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam, Bush and Saddam. We don't want no war. We need the unity. We don't want no war. Strictly love and unity. Yeah.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.